Hi, this is Jennifer Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. Well, Trump has lost it. Now, I know I have said this before, and many of you have thought this before, but we have seen something this week that I can only describe as a physical and mental breakdown. What happened? Well, on Monday at a rally that was in the form of a town hall, he took just a few questions. And then he said, well, let's listen to some music. And he remained on stage for about 40 minutes, rocking back and forth, rocking, rocking, rocking. What was he doing? I have no idea. Either he couldn't go on, or he lost track of time, or he forgot what he was going to say, or he couldn't hear. Whatever the explanation is, this is not normal behavior. He completely lost it. And it was so bad that the New York Times was forced to report it. Yes, they reported that he had this very bizarre episode. How do you explain this other than something is wrong with his brain? Normal people don't do this, and professional politicians don't do this. And you could tell everybody on stage was a little bit nervous, like, what the heck is going on? Well, we really don't know what the heck is going on because the man won't release his medical records. Oh, yeah, he's taken cognitive tests, he keeps telling us. Yeah, right. He hasn't released his medical records. He hasn't released these tests, which people surmise is not an indication of dementia or other serious mental problems. He's released nothing. And of course, he hides from Kamala Harris. He won't do a second debate. And he hides from tough interviewers like 60 Minutes or any other mainstream outlet. So Kamala Harris did something very smart on Monday when she went to Erie, Pennsylvania. She said, roll tape. Now, at that point, she didn't have film of the rocking back and forth number, but she did have film of him making these wild threats that people who oppose him are the enemy from within, and we should use the National Guard to get those people. That was pretty frightful stuff. And she ran it, and she ran it with a huge crowd present and forced the mainstream media to carry it. Yep, that's the way you have to do it, because otherwise they're not going to feature that. They're going to portray this as Trump in another animated performance, suggested that. Bop, 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 bop. No, he's calling anyone who opposes him the enemy within, and he's prepared to use force to shut us up or throw us out of the country. So it was a great move. I think she should do it every time, and she has more material. Not only does she have Monday's catastrophe, but on Tuesday, he sat down for an interview at an economic council. Why he does these, I don't know, because as you will hear, he comes across as a blithering idiot. And he was interviewed at length, and it was a disaster. First of all, the interviewer was very good. He would ask him something like, well, isn't it true that tariffs are going to be essentially levied on the consumer and they're going to pay $4,000? And he said, no. And the interviewer said, it's simple math. Or when he went off topic, flapping his gums about something else when the topic was Google, the interviewer patiently asked at the end, yes, but I was asking about Google. Could you answer that question? And he frankly made Trump look like a moron, which he is. And it wasn't because the questions were that difficult or were gotcha questions. For example, he asked, what would you do since you want to cut spending? What would you remove? And Trump said, I kid you not, oh, we need a new Air Force One. That is not cutting spending, that is adding to spending. So he is completely incapable of having a normal, calm, responsive interview. And what's worse, he gets very angry when he gets caught being a dullard. So he attacked the interviewer, he attacked the Wall Street Journal, and he also attacked American auto workers. Yes, he said any child, any moron can open a box of parts and assemble a car. After all, these people are not worth much. So that's a really interesting way of going after the working class vote, calling them children, and suggesting that a child can do their job. So that's Donald Trump. He is coming apart at the seams. Now, he's been bad. He has always been bad. We know because we watch them that his rallies are complete shit shows, and Kamala Harris has repeatedly invited people to go watch them, and now she's showing excerpts. But this is a whole new level of crazy. This is a whole new level of brain malfunction. So what is happening? The best explanation I've heard, talking to psychiatrists, psychologists, Trump watchers, is that as the pressure builds on him, as he begins to suspect he might just lose this election, and I believe he will, and the result might be that, yes, he could go to jail because the prosecutions will resume, he is beginning to panic. The walls are closing in. He's beginning to lose it. He insists now that Kamala Harris is the one with the mental problems. Oops, projection. That's a surefire sign he's worried about his own mental health. It is all coming apart. And so he's coming apart. He was not someone well mentally situated before this election. After all, he convinced himself that he'd won the last one, and he has always delved into violence and racism. That's nothing new. But the complete inability to function in a campaign event, that's something new. And I suspect, I have no inside information, that we're going to see and hear more about it from Kamala Harris, because she has figured out something that is quite true. First of all, the more people see of her, the more they like her. That's why she's out doing a lot more media. She's even going to do a Fox News interview. She might do Joe Rogan. She already did 60 Minutes. So the more she is out there, whether it's hard news shows or whether it's softer programming like The View or something in between like Howard Stern, she knows her getting out there, her being energetic, and by the way, her releasing her own medical records reassures people she's sprite, she's ready for the job, she's on the ball, and she's a likable, nice person. And now she's figured out the flip side of that, which is she has to force the press to cover Trump's insanity because they are completely averse to doing their job. They had no trouble driving President Biden out of the race for being old and non-responsive, but they will not fully describe, explain Trump's maladies to the American people. You can say they want him to win. You can say they just want a horse race. You can say they're deathly afraid of the MAGA. Whatever the explanation is, they have not covered his insanity and his extremism and radicalism and fascism the way they should. So now she's forcing them to. Now she's giving them no alternative because she's going to do this, I suspect, at every campaign event. And if they're going to cover her, they're going to have to cover her references, her roll tape episodes, and her takedowns of Donald Trump. Now, that's how you win an election. In the final weeks of the campaign, when people are finally paying attention, when people are getting their early ballots, when people are filling out absentee ballots, now is the time to put the pedal to the metal and to really pull out all the stops. And that's what she's doing. So is it going to work? I think so. I think she has a tremendous advantage. And when you put on top of that, that she has an actual campaign strategy and a campaign staff that can turn out the vote, why, I think you're going to have a Kamala Harris winner. But remember, not going to happen without you. So get out there and vote. And remember, democracy depends on it. I think my decision to go to law school all those years ago has finally paid off. Yes, I practiced as a lawyer, but it seems that more and more of what I write about in politics is actually about the law. And that's because we have now gotten to a stage in our politics in which everything gets litigated. So where are we in terms of Trump-related litigation? Well, first of all, there is still looming out there the January 6th case that Jack Smith has filed in Washington, D.C. And it's easy to forget about it, but it is poised to go forward, at least for a little bit while, if Trump loses. If Trump wins, he's simply going to order his Justice Department to dismiss it. He doesn't even have to pardon himself. He'll just tell the lawyers to drop the whole thing. So if you want any measure of justice, he cannot win because he will never be held accountable. But if he doesn't win, then that process goes on. But we also have something new to worry about, and that is the attacks this time around. If you remember, there were 60 lawsuits last time in 2020 challenging the outcome. Well, you have almost 200 lawsuits that have already been filed, and we haven't counted a single vote yet. So how do we make sense of this? What do we do about it? Are we really at the mercy of the Supreme Court, which has shown itself to be hyper-partisan time and time again? Luckily, I have the perfect person to explain this all to us. In fact, he wrote a book called How to Steal a Presidential Election, and that is Matthew Seligman. Matthew is a very well-regarded constitutional lawyer. He's litigated in some of these cases involving Trump's criminal liability and has appeared as an amici, the friend of the court, in some of this litigation. And he is a professor at the Constitutional Center at Stanford Law School. So to help us figure all of this out, Matthew, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Jen.
It's great to have you. I want to talk about two general topics today. The first is what remains of the January 6th litigation. And the second is what I think is going to be the replay of January 6th. And that is Trump's maneuvering, his lawyers maneuvering in advance of Election Day 2024. So let's start with 2020. The Supreme Court took Jack Smith's indictment and kind of sent it back as Swiss cheese. Some stuff's immune, some stuff may be immune, some stuff isn't immune. And Jack Smith revised his indictment and put together a whole bunch of evidence. Do you think he has complied with the Supreme Court's roadmap, if you could call it a roadmap, to get past these various category tests that the court has set up?
I think he has. And I think your question points to an important aspect of the Supreme Court's decision, which is that it sets out a general framework for how to analyze the immunity question, but it's really quite general and it doesn't have a lot of detail about how to apply the test that it laid out. So what that test says is that there are three categories of conduct. The first category is core executive functions for which the president is absolutely immune. Then on the other end of the spectrum is private conduct, non-official conduct for which there is no immunity. And then in the middle, there's a category of conduct that is official, but not core executive functions. And the president is presumptively immune for that, but that presumption can be overcome if holding the former president criminally responsible for that conduct wouldn't pose any risk to undermining the functioning of the executive branch. Now, the problem is that the Supreme Court didn't give a lot of guidance about which conduct falls into which category, and I think maybe most importantly, how to overcome that presumption in the middle category. What constitutes interference with the functioning of the executive branch? Because you can imagine that it, in the eyes of different jurists, that test can be applied in very, very different ways.
Well, one thing he did is he dropped a line of evidence which had to do with Trump's manipulation of the Justice Department, because that seemed to be what the court was talking about, the president directing a cabinet department, and that would be immune. So he dropped that. He also put in a lot of language and more detail that Trump, in all of these post-election shenanigans, was acting as a private litigant, a private candidate. Do you think he's done enough there in terms of adding the gloss and adding some interesting facts, such as closing out the Justice Department lawyers and relying on private lawyers? Is that kind of evidence enough, do you think, to get past at least Judge Chutkan?
I think it is, because the overall theme, which the special counsel articulates and then backs up with evidence and evidence and evidence, is that this was a fundamentally private scheme. Now, we all know that the ultimate goal of this scheme was private, because it was Donald Trump trying to remain in power, or just to be the next president. And the prior president has no official interest in who the next president is. And so we all know that the goal was a private political goal for Donald Trump. But what this brief, what the superseding indictment and now this brief illustrates in great detail, is that the means through which Donald Trump executed that, the scheme to achieve that private goal was itself, those means were themselves private. And so he didn't use the levers of official governmental power for the most part to try to execute this scheme. He used private campaign lawyers. He even had to go outside of his campaign to bring in lawyers like John Eastman and Sidney Powell and Kenneth Chesbro to try to execute this this legal scheme. He was coordinating with Ronna McDaniel, who was the chair of the RNC at the time. And so this is a scheme that was executed through private lawyers and private political operatives to try to maintain his office in power. And so as a result of that, the vast majority of the conduct alleged in the superseding indictment falls into that category where it's not official. And so it shouldn't be immune at all. And there's no need to overcome any presumption of immunity at all.
Now, a couple legal commentators, not you, have opined that there's something nefarious about Jack Smith doing all this stuff, that he's putting out all these facts. It's so close to the election. He's playing games. What's the answer to that? And was this Jack Smith's schedule, or was this the court's imposed schedule?
This was the district court's imposed schedule. So he was ordered to file this brief. But beyond that, the Supreme Court said exactly what to do, which is when it issued its decision on July 1st, it said that this issue should be addressed by the district court immediately before anything else. And that's consistent with immunity doctrines across the law, where the entire point of an immunity doctrine is to try to protect the defendant from having to go through the burdensome process of a trial and pretrial litigation that's unnecessary. That's exactly why this entire proceeding was stayed from December until when the Supreme Court issued its decision in July, because the defendant has a right to be protected from all of these non-immunity proceedings. If Donald Trump wanted to proceed with these non-immunity proceedings about other stuff, he could have been doing that all the way back in December through July, but he didn't want to do that because the purpose of immunity is to protect the defendant from those pretrial proceedings that don't have to do with immunity. So you have to do immunity first. That's what the Supreme Court said, and that's what's consistent with the doctrine in all areas. And so then the question is, should the district court have just put a pin in this until after the election? And now we're getting to a question of, okay, so what really constitutes intentional interference with the political process here? Is it going through an expeditious schedule that would happen in any other case? Or is it intentionally delaying that ordinary process in order to prevent this brief from being filed before the election? You know, I think it's pretty clear that just going by the ordinary schedule is the non-interference here.
And in fact, Trump has asked to delay his response until after the election. So the judge is further accommodating him. But it is the irony of ironies that the Supreme Court, which has bent over backwards, both in taking up the case in this slow boat to China kind of arrangement and in this complicated fact-based analysis, has put Trump exactly where he didn't want to be, which is a whole lot of this evidence did come out before the election. But I suppose you can talk to Justices Alito, Thomas et al. If you don't like the schedule, because that's what they came up with.
And I will say, you know, it Donald Trump could, I suppose, blame the Supreme Court for putting him in this position where Jack Smith has filed this brief, but he can also thank the Supreme Court for putting him in a position where he's not on trial. Because the ultimate upshot of all of these immunity proceedings is that the core of the plot was private conduct, and it's not really plausible to suggest otherwise. Even Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Barrett, in her concurring opinion, said that it was clear that the fake elector plot was not official conduct, that it was talking to Ronna McDaniel at the RNC, that the president has no role in organizing slates of electors or in the submission of that, of those certificates. And so at the end of the day, unless he is pardoned or the charges are dropped against him, this will ultimately go to trial. And so the last almost year of proceedings in this case have been an academic constitutional question that almost certainly won't impact whether he goes to trial or not. Now, it may narrow some of the allegations by getting rid of the Department of Justice aspect of it, but that wasn't really the core of the plot. The core of the plot was to submit alternate electors and then try to get Congress or Vice President Pence to do something about it on January 6th. That was it. And that's still going to go to trial.
So two questions to wrap up this portion of our talk. First of all, if he gets an adverse ruling, is he going to run up to the Supreme Court again? And secondly, do you think there are five votes to uphold a detailed fact-based ruling by Judge Chutkan?
I think he will appeal, and I think it's likely that the courts will hold that there is once again an immediate appeal up through ultimately, presumably, the Supreme Court prior to trial, because this is again going to be about immunity. So the Supreme Court has been subject to a lot of criticism in how it handled the first appeal. And one of the aspects that I find most troubling is that it didn't apply its own test in the preceding iteration of this appeal, because there's no set of facts under which organizing false slates of electors is anything official at all. And so the Supreme Court just could have said so back in July. It didn't. And so we're going to have to go back up again. Now, as things have turned out, that didn't realistically make the difference between whether a trial happened before the election or not. That goose was already cooked once the Supreme Court took the first appeal. But it does mean that we're, you know, ultimately going to have this second appeal that could delay a trial if the charges are not dropped, from sometime in early 2025 to sometime in late 2025 or early 2026. And this is just going to drag on and on. Now, once the appeal gets there, I think it's very clear that there are at least four votes for a Supreme Court holding that there are sufficient allegations in the indictment that are not protected by immunity to go ahead to trial. Whether five really comes down to your theory of John Roberts. I think he's broadly been thought of as an institutionalist, but I think a lot of legal commentators have really questioned where his allegiance lies in the aftermath of the immunity decision. Now, you know, I think that he was trying probably just to keep the courts out of this and hope it goes away. I think that was a catastrophic error. But I don't think he's gone full MAGA. But, you know, what ultimately we're going to have to see is this is a genuine question about whether he will go with what I think was the well-reasoned position of Amy Coney Barrett, that this is just not official conduct at all and so not subject to any kind of immunity, or whether he's gone more the direction of a Justice Alito and a Justice Thomas.
Well, I think two observations about this. One, we have now seen that Amy Coney Barrett has moved to the left of the Chief Justice, that at least she seems to be trying in some of these cases to be more reasonable. And secondly, that if news reports are correct, and John Roberts was shocked that the opinion got such a thumbs down from the legal community and from the political community, then that's a pretty good argument, I think, for term limits, because it means these justices are really out of touch and they should stay out of politics. So let's switch gears now to this election. Now, many people may not be aware, but there are almost 200 cases that have already been filed in state courts, some in federal courts, all over the country, in which Republicans are trying to anticipate the vote and either exclude certain ballots or give latitude to boards and canvassers to exclude ballots. What are they up to? No one has counted any votes. We've just begun early voting in a lot of states. Why are they filing all of these lawsuits?
Well, I think it's just that the lawfare about elections has increased in intensity, tenfold or a hundredfold, even from what we saw in 2020. I think the lesson that the Republican Party and the MAGA movement took from 2020 is that lawfare was the way forward, and they didn't do it well enough. And so they are exceptionally well-funded now, both within the party apparatus and outside groups like Stephen Miller's American Legal Foundation. And so we see these lawsuits that fall into roughly three categories. So one category is litigation about who gets to vote. And so there's been news in the last couple of days about some conservative lawsuits that are trying to prevent overseas voters from being able to vote. And they have the right to vote under a federal statute. And that includes military voters. And there's been quite a bit of backlash about that. So they're trying to limit overseas voters' right to vote. So that's about who gets to vote. Then there's cases about how people get to vote. And so, we saw in 2020, and we are already seeing again, litigation in Pennsylvania about the various permutations of mail-in ballots, when, how the envelope is sealed and, does somebody put their birthday or the date on which they mail it and things like that. Things that I'll emphasize have absolutely nothing to do with the real security of the ballot and whether this is actually an eligible ballot that was cast by an eligible voter. But nonetheless, there are these technical requirements. And so there's litigation already about whether those votes can be counted, again, under the presumption that they're same as in 2020, that mail-in votes are more likely to be Democratic votes than to be Republican votes. Now we're also seeing this new wave of litigation prior to the election that we didn't really see before, until after the election in 2020, which is about who gets to certify the election results. And so certification is really just supposed to be a ministerial task where a county board of elections, for example, says, okay, we've gotten all the vote tallies from each precinct and we're going to add them up and then pass them along to, for example, the state secretary of state to then tabulate the statewide results. That's supposed to be ministerial, not because there's no way to challenge election results or to have recounts, but because it's done through a different procedural mechanism. County boards of elections aren't the right place to do that. Court is, and then there are recounts through administrative bodies as well. And so there are ways to challenge election results, and those have been used into increasing degrees and with increasing frequency over the last several election cycles. What we see now is this litigation to try to take the ability to review the election results, not by the courts, but rather by these partisan political entities like county boards of election. And that's unlawful. And it's also a preview of the playbook that we fear that MAGA Republicans are going to try to use. We've already seen in prior election cycles that there are county boards of elections that have tried to do this. And the fact that there are these lawsuits ahead of time, which thankfully have failed so far, trying to establish a legal authority for these county boards of election to disregard the will of the people, that's a very dangerous sign. Now, those lawsuits have failed, and that's really important, but it does give us an indication of where things are going.
One decision that we got just on Tuesday was a judge in Georgia who basically said to the state election board, you have no discretion. They passed a rule that essentially says, well, if we suspect there was foul play, we get to, I don't know, play Sherlock Holmes and look around for evidence or delay certification. And the judge says, what are you talking about? You don't have any right to avoid certification. That seems to be so overwhelmingly correct and obvious. I suppose that's reassuring. Now, would there be other judges in other states who could possibly go the other way? Or do you think this helps set a bit of a precedent, even though state laws differ on the process?
So I think that this is a good development. And although state law differs, state election law differs on a lot of different particular issues. On this, it really doesn't, because, the basis of the judge's decision here is that county boards of election, so the state election board, which gets to set rules for how elections are conducted, said that it passed this rule last month saying that county election boards have the discretion to not certify. They can conduct a reasonable inquiry into the election. And this judge said no. And the reason is because the state statute says that the county election boards shall certify. That's the word, shall. That means must. No discretion. You have to do it. And that word shall, which creates a mandatory duty that can be enforced by a court order, that appears in state law across the country. And the idea is that certification has never been understood anywhere to be part of the dispute resolution process. What it's supposed to do is set a baseline. It's like, okay, we've got all the ballots. We're going to count them. These are the vote totals. And then if you want to challenge those, you want to have a recount or you want to have a court case, okay, you can challenge those and you can go to court, but certification is not the right place for that. And that's something that's set by state law, but it's the state laws are just really consistent about this. So I think it's good to have this these judicial decisions up front to try to provide clarity. So there's a way in which we can be thankful that the Georgia State Election Board did this ahead of time. So we have this judicial decision, which I'm very confident will be upheld on appeal, that these are mandatory duties. And then hopefully other states where there's been this movement afoot, Arizona, perhaps, Wisconsin, perhaps, et cetera, we can sort of snuff this out and put out the flames really before they start roaring. Because part of the concern is chaos, that in the post-election period, it was already chaotic in 2020. And now there's concerns that, you know, instead of just having pressure on county election boards, you have Donald Trump calling the Wayne County election board members in Michigan, you're going to have hundreds of county election boards flirting with this and potentially actually pulling the trigger. And that's going to create an enormous disruption to the process, potentially create significant delays in the resolution and certification of the electors, which can pose a real problem once we get to December. So even though these judicial decisions are really good and hopefully answer the question once and for all, nonetheless, there's the possibility that it's just going to be too much chaos, and that will then create its own problems.
Now, to be clear, the law, Georgia, for example, is you shall, meaning if you break the law, you are potentially in violation of the law. There may be civil penalties, there may be criminal penalties. And we did have a situation in 2022 where one county in Arizona, you had some people who were refusing to certify for no particular reason, based on no evidence. And as soon as the notion was out there that they could face criminal prosecution, boy, did they hurry up and get the job done. So there are ways of addressing this. One big topic that we're hearing a lot of, and it should make everyone suspicious, is this notion that illegal immigrants are voting. Somehow they're on the voter rolls and they are voting. Now, it's not necessarily new. Trump tried this after he actually won in 2016 because he was obsessed with the fact that he lost the popular vote. And he set up a commission to try to find 3 or 5 million votes, never found them. But it's back, and it's back in a big way. And you hear him talking about it, the campaign talking about it, and you see this activity aimed at getting certain people off the rolls. What are they doing? It is illegal for undocumented immigrants or any non-citizen, frankly, to vote. What are they doing here?
Well, I think it's part of a multi-front war to try to undermine confidence in the results of the election. So just to set it out up front, there's no evidence whatsoever, despite lots of looking. As you mentioned, there have been commissions. The Heritage Foundation, which is as conservative as you can get on these issues, has a database going back decades, and they've only found, you know, maybe a couple dozen total cases where somebody who's not a citizen has attempted to vote. And in none of those cases that I'm aware of was the vote actually counted. And so this is really, really fundamentally a non-phenomenon. It just doesn't happen. But nonetheless, you know, you see anti-immigrant rhetoric on other issues about, for example, crime. And so it's not surprising that you now see this sort of symbiotic messaging where illegal immigrants, they say, are responsible for all sorts of crime and other social ills in America, and they also undermine elections. Now, that's untrue across the board. The evidence indicates in all of these areas that undocumented immigrants or non-citizens in general are not responsible for these problems. In the case of election irregularities, there are no real significant problems for which they could be responsible. Now, where is this going, though? Well, it's going a couple places. One is that the myth of non-citizen voting is being used as a pretext to try to impose more restrictive voting procedures. The idea is, oh, we need to put more more restrictions in place to make sure that non-citizens are not voting. Now, why would you want to do this, even if there were no non-citizens that were voting? Well, because those restrictions could have a partisan differential impact, which could then redound to the benefit of whoever's advocating for those changes. And so, for example, Arizona, which is widely known as the state that has the most stringent requirements for a proof of citizenship to vote in state elections. Well, so if you register to vote in Arizona, if you provide proof of citizenship, which is not easy, by the way, a driver's license isn't enough. You can vote in state elections, but if you don't, you can vote only in federal elections. Now, how many voters are there? A couple tens of thousands that don't provide the proof of citizenship. And those are overwhelmingly concentrated among college-age students in college towns and on Native American reservations. These are two demographic groups where there are understandable reasons why people don't have access to their original birth certificate or a passport, and they tend to vote Democratic. And so that's part of why this is happening. The other reason this is happening is because building up this myth, this narrative of non-citizen voting will be the pretext that is used to try to challenge the results of the election after the fact. If Donald Trump loses, then he will say, as he did in 2016 and in 2020, that the only reason he lost in 2016, because the loss of popular vote, is because millions of non-citizens voted. You see prominent conservative voices like Elon Musk falsely saying that Democrats are importing millions of non-citizens to vote in this election season. That is false. That is slander. And it is also going to be used as the pretext to engage in whatever legal manipulations are attempted after the election is concluded.
Trump tried to show fraud in other ways in 2020, and there were 60 some odd lawsuits. He lost all of them but one, and the one was not really significant. Courts do, even conservative judges and conservative courts, do need facts. So when this goes to the courts, are you reasonably confident that state and local judges in the initial court, district court, a superior court, are going to toss these like they did last time? Or are you concerned that there may be unfavorable judges out there who say, yeah, there could be some illegal voting. Why don't we, run it again? Or why don't we throw out some votes?
So I'm going to give you a lawyerly answer, which is
it's a
qualified yes that I have confidence in the judicial system as a whole. Right. And so why in the judicial system as a whole? Well, because there are individual judges that have shown increasing willingness to, let's say, not follow precedent, not follow the facts. So there's Judge Kaczmarek in the Northern District of Texas. There's Judge Cannon, quite famously, in the classified documents case in the Southern District of Florida. So there are judges out there that I would be concerned about. But the judicial system as a whole is, I think, still, at least on these issues, dominated by judges who will adhere to the rule of law, at least outside of very specific circumstances. And so, for example, there's a Third Circuit Trump appointee, Judge Bibas, who, famously rejected one of the Trump lawsuits in 2020 by saying that in court you have to provide evidence and law, and here both are lacking. And apparently that has resulted in him being persona non grata among the MAGA crowd. Now, so the judicial system as a whole, I think, has judges that, at least on election law issues, will will follow the law and will follow the facts. Now, why is my answer qualified? Well, because there could be cases that are close enough that we get something like Bush v. Gore. You know, the Supreme Court, which deserves a lot of criticism for the way that it's conducted itself over the last several years, nonetheless rejected every appeal in 2020. There was an attempt to strike down what remains of the Voting Rights Act last year, and a redistricting case coming out of Alabama. And John Roberts wrote an opinion upholding the Voting Rights Act. There was an attempt to get the Supreme Court to adopt the independent state legislature theory, and it didn't. It rejected it, except for a thin sliver. So I think even the Supreme Court has shown itself to be plenty reliable in most election law cases. Now, why is my answer still a qualified yes? Well, first, the immunity decision does give me pause, because it does suggest to me that maybe things are changing in the critical vote, and the Chief Justice is the critical vote. And the other is that the circumstances have never been presented to this current court where it's a single legal issue that affects a relatively small number of ballots that nonetheless could decide the presidency. And in that circumstance, well, then I have a little bit less confidence, because the partisan motivations are going to be that much stronger. You know, in 2020, there were seven states where the results would have had to have been reversed. And most of those states had had margins that were overwhelming. I mean, hundreds of thousands of votes in some cases. And so it wasn't really close. And so the Supreme Court would have had to have gone on an extreme limb to try to actually do something that could have reversed the ultimate outcome of the election. If we come down to a couple of hundred votes in Pennsylvania and the whole election turns on Pennsylvania and it's a more novel issue of law, do I think the partisan motivations might enter into the justices' decision-making in that case? Yes, I think we have to be honest that they would.
And this is really the difference between Bush v. Gore, which is coming a case that really turned on one state and less than 1,000 votes. The difference between that and Trump's gigantic conspiracy theory that covers multiple states, tens if not hundreds of thousands of votes. And what I hear you saying is, okay, this court may put their finger on the scale, but they're not stupid. They're not going to do so in a way that will never in a million years look credible and not deliver the election to Trump anyway. They might, if it's very, very narrow and there's some place to put their hang their hat on, but why would they intervene in a case, for example, challenging Pennsylvania, if the number of electoral votes is frankly immaterial, or the margin of victory is 100,000 votes, which is just enormous in terms of voter outcomes? Is that kind of what you're driving at, that there's hedging and then there's ludicrous, and they have enough trouble these days without being ludicrous?
That's right. And I think, you know, you said they're not going to reach a decision that would never be plausible. And I think you said 100 million years. I think the real psychological constraint here is they don't want to reach a decision that won't be plausible in 100 years. Because as much as they care about partisan outcomes, these are people who are on the world stage. And they do, I think, on some level, have an eye towards history. And so for some of them, that may not matter. Or it may be that their view of, you know, being on the right side of history means doing what Justice Alito does, or doing what Justice Thomas does. But for someone, and we're really talking about Chief Justice Roberts here, for him, I do think that he has an eye towards, you know, the way the Supreme Court will be viewed and the way that he will be viewed in 100 years. And, you know, the Supreme Court was criticized really severely in the aftermath of Bush v. Gore, but its reputation recovered relatively quickly. And that's something that I'm sure he's aware of. But if the court went to some extreme length to reinstall Donald Trump as president in a way that couldn't really be defensible by anyone speaking with a straight face about the law, then I don't think that rebound in the standing of the court would happen. And I think John Roberts knows that. And I don't think that he wants to be remembered in 100 years as the person who, you know, sacrificed all of his integrity to install Donald Trump of all people in the presidency.
Right. He sacrificed three quarters of it. So why lose whatever he has left, right? Let me take a step back. And after hearing all of this and listening to Trump for all these years and all of these lawsuits and all of these allegations, the average voter may have a very fundamental question. Is the system secure? Is my vote going to be counted? What's your response to someone who asked that fundamental question?
The fundamental answer to that fundamental question is yes. Now, let me unpack that a little bit. I think that the right way to think about this is that there are really three questions and three answers. And so we can tell an arc of a story over the next couple of months in three acts. The first act is my vote secure? Will it be counted? And the answer is yes. The election administration system, for all the attacks that are made on it, is actually quite secure and sound. And so it will be a safe and secure election. Your vote will be counted. And the results of the tally will reflect the votes that were cast by eligible voters. That's Act One. Act Two is that I think we should anticipate that there's going to be an unprecedented assault on those legitimate results, that Donald Trump has greater means and greater motive to challenge the results in 2024 than he had in 2020. Although he's not in the White House, the legal team that is working on these issues for the Republican Party, for the Trump campaign, is much better prepared now than it was in 2020. You had a shambolic effort of, you know, the Keystone Cops in 2020, and it's going to be much better executed this time. He also has a much stronger motive this time. The downside risk of him in 2020 was that he would go to Florida and play golf the rest of his life around sycophants. Now the downside risk, going back to our first topic, is that he will spend the rest of his life in jail. And so he is highly motivated to ensure that he ends up in the White House so he can drop the charges against himself. So that second act is coming. If Donald Trump loses the election, which he might not, but if he does, I think we should expect that there is going to be the second act of an unprecedented assault on the certification of the election results. But then there's the third act. And the third act is that unprecedented assault will most likely fail. It failed in 2020. I do think that it's going to be a stronger assault this time, but I think that the judicial system, the legal system, the lawyers that are working on these issues are going to be able to make sure that these assaults fail and that the lawful results, whoever won the most votes in the right states, ultimately is sworn in on January 20th.
Now, there is one thing that voters can do, aside from making sure if they fill out an absentee ballot, they follow those rules precisely, or if they go to vote, they completely fill out the bubble in the correct way. And that is the margin of victory if you're going to have all of these challenges. Sounds like it's more important than ever. It's not enough, although I'm sure she would take it, for Kamala Harris to squeeze by a few hundred votes in Pennsylvania, because that's asking, unfortunately, in this era, to be deluged with lawsuits. But if the margin isn't close, I don't want to say it's impossible to cheat, but it's harder to, and it's less plausible when they do come around. I know the campaign doesn't want to put it that way, but you and I think, are in agreement that the way the average voter helps defend against this is get out and vote against the people who want to take our democracy away.
Absolutely. And so the way I think about it is every vote increases the margin of victory, and that hopefully will put it outside the margin of manipulation. That if 2020 had come down to the margin of victory that there was in 2000 in Florida, if it just came down to Georgia or Wisconsin and it was just 538 votes, well, then suddenly, I don't know how the post-election period in 2020 goes. But because it was multiple states, because the margin of victory in those states was in the tens of thousands, approaching 100,000 in Pennsylvania, it just was too far for bad actors to try to reverse the result. And part of that is a coordination problem, you know, because if it's one state, okay, then that governor, say, has to just do their bad thing. But if it's seven states, then are you really going to coordinate for all of them to do the bad thing? Are you really going to have the Supreme Court decide seven different cases to flip the results in all of those states? And so I think by increasing the margin of victory, and both within states and across the electoral college in different states, it makes it substantially less likely that serious attempts will be made that put things in real question. And so everybody, I think, around the country has an ample incentive to go out and vote, because that's going to be what makes this outside the margin of manipulation. And that's going to make it that much easier, both to land the plane safely for who gets inaugurated on January 20th, but also hopefully to start doing the work of putting this behind us. I do not think that we can continue to do this in every election cycle, where there are these rampant wildfires of conspiracy theories that make every election into this existential, you know, battle between, you know, sort of the rule of law on the one hand and constitutional arsonists on the other.
Well, this, as I anticipated, is extremely helpful and informative, whether you're a lawyer or not. And the people who I really hope are listening are those people on television who are going to report on this. And hopefully, if in fact the Associated Press and the other networks call the election for Kamala Harris, that they don't qualify that by saying the election is in dispute or the election is somehow controversial. Once we have a winner, we should announce the winner. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you for all you're doing. You're one of those people who is litigating, traveling around, filing friends of the court brief. So no sleep for you for the next month or so. Stay well. And thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Jen.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
And that was Matthew Seligman. I told you he was a smart guy. And what I love about Matthew is he explains this in very simple English that I can understand, that non-lawyers can understand. And essentially what he's telling us is Trump is going to raise a ruckus. He's going to come up with every screwball idea and claim and allegation. But at the end of the day, you actually need facts. You actually need evidence that something went terribly awry. And the chances of something going awry on a grand scale in multiple states is close to zero. Now, if we do have a Bush v. Gore, one state is going to decide it all, and the margin is tiny, and then there's reason to worry a lot. But as another friend of the show, Mark Elias, mentioned to me the other day, that is the proverbial black swan event. That's something that happens once in a lifetime, we hope, or once every couple hundred years, we hope. So the chances of that repeating itself, in other words, giving the Supreme Court a chance to really screw up an election and shift the election to Donald Trump, is, I don't want to say zero, but it's very, very small. So I think Matthew put it best at the end, which is you can do your part. First of all, you can vote properly. That is, you can send in your mail-in ballot with the safety envelope and sign it and date it and follow those instructions to a T. You can vote early as well, or you can show up on election day. But you also can turn out and turn your friends and relations out in numbers great enough that it will be very hard to cheat. If it comes down to one state, just a couple of hundred votes, as we said, that's a problem. But if Kamala Harris, as Joe Biden did, racks up over 300 electoral votes or something close to that in multiple states, winning states by tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of votes, it will hold. And you should be confident that it will hold. And the other thing that you can do is disabuse your friends who may be hearing a lot of scuttlebutt that, oh, illegal immigrants are voting. No, they're not. There's zero evidence of that. It's illegal. They would go to jail. They would be deported. It's not happening. So do your part in spreading truthful information, knocking down the lies and the disinformation, and most of all, vote. So there you have it. If you enjoyed the program, please tell your friends. They can find us wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.